Good evening. This is Mark Lynch, and this is Inquiry. My guest tonight is Gísli Páldsson, Professor Emeritus of Anthropology at the University of Iceland. And we're talking about his new book, The Last of Its Kind, The Search for the Great Auk and the Discovery of Extinction. Gísli, welcome to the show. It's a real pleasure to talk to you about this book.
Thank you, Mark. I'm really glad you like it and willing to talk about this.
I think I thought I had read everything about the great auk that I could possibly know, and this book surprised me. And actually, I learned a lot from this book. Now, you're an anthropologist. What brought you to writing this book about the great auk?
Yeah, good question. I've been interested in birds since I was a kid. I grew up on a small island south of Iceland, and there was lots of seabirds, some throughout the year, and also I spent summers on the mainland in a wetland area, and there was another soundscape, and I collected birds' eggs, and somehow I was attuned to them from early on, but I'm not an expert, the great auk was when I was in school, in the secondary grammar school, I guess. We heard about the final killings and there's a kind of guilt among the elder generation about having done the final blow. And somehow this was dormant in my mind. And about 6 years ago, I came across a few articles by anthropologists, and I was stunned to see they were citing the Gerfall manuscripts in Cambridge, which are kind of the focus of my book, and I felt I had to. And I felt I had to dive into the manuscripts, and once I learned they were there and accessible, there was no way back. I must add that I was interested in human-animal relations before this book set in, and it's a big issue in anthropology. The relations between humans and animals, and that helped to spark my interest.
Before we go on, let's describe what the great auk was for the audience. It was an alcid, so it is related to puffins, but describe what it was. It was a unique bird.
Yeah, it was flightless, tiny wings. That was the main characteristic of one of them, and it was tall, about 80 centimeters, and lots of meat. And so it was hunted early on for meat. And it apparently stooped tall on the cliffs, so there's a certain pride in the posture, according to some of the early descriptions. And the beak is noticeable, with big with white stripes, and there the Scandinavian name and the name the Brits used, Geirfugl, Geirfugl in Icelandic. It's Old Norse. Refers to spear. That's at least one theory. And there was an interesting white spot between the beak and the eye, and so it was quite noticeable. And still, there were not that many descriptions of it, because it would nest on isolated islands where the bird felt safe from predators, and the hunters would act quickly and return back. and hardly noticing anything special with the bird.
Now, ever since I was a young child, I had learned that the last great auks were killed on Eldy Island, sometimes called the Meal Sack, in June of 1844, and that the person responsible was Kettle Kettleson. And ever since I was a child, I found it amazing that they knew the name of the person who supposedly was the person who shattered the last egg and killed the last two birds. Now, today, great auks are known from, there's stuffed specimens scattered throughout the world. There's skins, there's organs, feathers. But this book that you talked about, I had never heard of before, the Gerfowl books. Now, talk to me about what those are.
Yeah. Naturalists realized that around 1850, the bird was in decline. I mean, there was a network among naturalists and bird collectors and egg collectors, and the people realized that the bird was getting scarce, the price was getting higher on markets, museums, and private collections, both stuffed birds and eggs. And two Brits, Alfred Newton and John Woolley, were keen to see the bird. And they were interested in the decline itself. They were not still not on the sort of hunting for extinction, so to speak. But they wanted to get to Iceland, and that was the last known habitat of the species. And they organized a trip, and they came here in 1858, hoping to see the bird alive and get onto Elde, the last hunting ground. And they were unable to go because of heavy seas, and it's a long journey on open rowing boats. And so the foreman with whom they had made a contract to go there called it off repeatedly, and eventually they gave up. So there was no way they would go to Elde that summer. But they stayed in the southwest for 2 months and changed the agenda in the sense that they would visit the members of the last crew. 12 were alive, if I remember correctly, and they interviewed them, some repeatedly, and pushed them on descriptions of the birds and the last sort of hunting trips and even the history of hunting in the islands on the Icelandic off the Icelandic shore, and these interviews were documented in a manuscript written by John Woolley, basically Alfred Newton, who he updated some things later on and cross references, but these are 900 pages written during the expedition in 1858. And they detail the interviews, what the fishermen are saying, and also the women who typically would do the stuffing and kind of knew the bird better, focusing on them for hours and even the intestines. So all this is packed in 900 pages, and quite a number of people had referred to the manuscripts, and they eventually became the property of Cambridge University Library. But most people had sort of, because you can't copy, it's not allowed to copy them.
Oh my God.
So people would have to go to the library.
Wait a minute. Wait. So why couldn't you copy them?
It's both, I think, because manuscripts are
delicate.
They're delicate, yes, and you have to preserve them and sort of constant use over decades.
So nobody's published a book of a reproduction.
No.
Oh my God.
No.
Because
there's also a property issue, and it turned out I was trying to push the library to give a copy to the National Museum of Iceland. In a way, this is an Icelandic saga.
Yeah.
And there's lots of indigenous groups throughout the world demanding their stuff back. And I was teasing the librarians in Cambridge. I mean, this is Icelandic. Please, at least give us a copy. But in the end, that was impossible. It turned out there was a property right on it, given the strange property law of Britain. So only in about 20 or 30 years they will be free. But what they did was to offer me to buy a digital copy. So I bought these 900 sheets in 900 photographs in high resolution. And it was stunning to see them, and I would enlarge the figures on my screen, trying to learn to digest the handwriting of Wally, basically.
You wrote that Wally's handwriting was very difficult to decipher.
Yeah, at first, but eventually I managed. And in between, there was stuff in Danish, which I read. So I spent weeks transcribing what I saw as the sort of the core of the stuff, and then started to write. And later on, I felt I had to go repeatedly back into the manuscripts, and I had this all on my computer.
Wow.
It was a wonderful project. I was really engaged with it, and I think I managed to convince the world that the manuscripts are a valuable thing and tell a unique history regarding discovery of extinction.
We'll get to that in a minute, but first and foremost,
yes,
they're an amazing document of life for the fishermen in that part of the southwest corner of Iceland. I mean, they interviewed all these people about the Great Auk, but there was all this other, you know, information about how people lived, what people thought about the Great Auk. It seems invaluable for the history of Iceland.
Yes, it is. And I published this book first in Icelandic, and it was very well received and nominated for two prizes.
Wow.
The two main prizes in the country, and there's lots of interest here in the bird, and has been since the last killings. It's partly the guilt, but also the fascination with losing one species sort of just around the corner.
Yeah. You're listening to WICN 90.5 FM. This is Inquiry. My name is Mark Lynch. My guest tonight is Gisli Pálsson, Professor Emeritus of Anthropology at the University of Iceland. And we're talking about his new book, which really surprised me. It's so fascinating. The Last of Its Kind, The Search for the Great Auk and the Discovery of Extinction. When Woolley and Newton returned, they sort of returned to Britain. They went their separate ways. John Woolley didn't live that much longer. He was engaged to be married, and then died before he was able to do it. But Alfred Newton took all the information and he started to write about extinction. And the point that you write about extensively in this book is the people didn't realize, a lot of naturalists didn't even understand extinction at that time. Some people were very skeptical that a human-caused extinction could happen, and that included Charles Darwin.
Yeah, that's true, and I think one could compare the sort of skepticism towards extinction in those days to current discussions of mass extinction. I mean, it's still difficult to fathom for most people that sort of there is a mass extinction ongoing, or at least impending. But extinction sort of came late. Darwin imagined it was only long durée, as the French say. It was only in deep history and in sort of millions of years. And with the discovery of fossils, doubts about extinction were fairly quickly settled. It was obvious there had been species, strange-looking in Devon in England, collected by Anning and studied by the French Cuvier. So these people helped to establish the idea that some species had been there all along and somehow disappeared. But even Cuvier, who accepted this, he was not interested in extinction and didn't accept that idea that species were gone for good. They had to be somewhere resting or moving about.
That happened here in North America with the passenger pigeon. In North America, it used to be one of the most common birds, abundant birds in the world, and the big flocks were disappearing. And when people wrote about that, they just assumed that they went elsewhere, that they went someplace else.
Yeah,
and they could not believe that the fact that they were becoming extinct.
Yeah, it was a bizarre idea in the 1850s.
Yeah.
And the fishermen that Wally and Newton interviewed, they wouldn't raise any idea about extinction. And it struck me afterwards. I didn't find a single reference to extinction in the Gerfaul books. It simply wasn't on the agenda, not even for Alfred Newton and John Wally. And the hunters they interviewed, they would say, well, the birds come and go. They may not be here on Elbe for a few years. They may be in the Faroes or Greenland or Norway, etc. But slowly this sank in. And Newton realized and wrote about this that several years after the Icelandic expedition, sort of his doubts were removed. The great dog was gone for good, and he began writing about bird protection and habitat protection.
It's amazing. So, as you write in your book, Newton's work has largely been undervalued. I've never heard him in reference to the ideas of human-caused extinction. And here he is writing about it in the 1800s, and he's never been given his due for publishing about this.
Yeah, it's true. He was kind of – he was a bit a strange guy. He was his interests were narrow, and he was not interested in theory. But he was extremely skillful as an observer in the details, and he was strongly against women in the lab, so to speak, and very macho guy apparently, and women were not allowed into Model College while he was alive. in Cambridge, and but still he deserves his due. And interestingly, in recent years, as I mentioned in the book, and I draw heavily on several authors. Interestingly, his interests turn into extinction fairly soon, and he has no doubt, and he has followers and kind of disciples who go out into the real world, and he helps to establish bird protection societies, etc.
Now we're going to run.
And somehow this remained fairly hidden. Although some people, ornithologists, were beginning to see the point recently.
Now we're almost out of time, but I have to ask you about Kettle Kettleson. You cast some serious doubt about whether he was the person responsible for killing the last great ox. Is there proof that he did it?
There's no proof. The only evidence we have is that he, according to Wallace's manuscript, he picked up the last egg and realized it was broken, and he laid it down. This is the wording. But in later accounts, he is pictured as so the killer of the last chick, and I think that's unfair, and it's silly to make one guy responsible for the decline of the species. I mean, the hunting was seriously killing the species in Newfoundland. Incidentally, I'm going to Newfoundland in June for a week to explore the site where the main killings were, the slaughterhouse in the 18th and 17th and 18th centuries.
I want to talk, before we run out of time, I want to talk about the fact that the great auk was flightless, but it was still migratory, and therefore it swam migratory routes in winter, because great auks made it all the way down to off the coast of Massachusetts, as well as off the coast of Europe.
Yeah, and even into the into the Mediterranean.
Isn't that amazing?
Yeah, it was in Alfred Newton's time. People didn't believe that the birds went north of the Arctic Circle, but they really did in northern Norway. Now, lots of accounts about that. So it swam widely. It must have been like a Boeing jet underwater. But that happened. That was the case with many seabirds, and they swam along the North Atlantic according to the season and the currents. And there's an interesting recent discovery of the hotspot and the bird hotspot in the middle of the North Atlantic between Newfoundland and France. And apparently lots of seabirds stopped there to refuel in a way, and either on the way south or north.
And there's even cave.
The great auk must have been there.
There's cave paintings that possibly could show a great auk in a cave painting?
Yeah, there is a cave near Marseille in France, and there's a recent museum, and I visited it last July, and I saw a reconstruction of the cave walls and photographs, and there are three images of great auks on the cave walls. Some people have expressed doubt about it, whether it's the great auk, but it seems really unmistakable. And that is, in fact, there's also an image in a cave in Italy, I think, with an unmistakable white spot on the head. But the three grey dogs, the three bird images in these cave wall, and it's called Kosker by the name of the diver who found it in 1985. The image is stunning, and it's a kind of logo for the Kosker Museum, which was visited by 1 million guests in the first year.
Wow.
We're
completely out of time. We've got to sign off because we're out of time. Yeah. My guest tonight has been Gísli Pálsson, Professor Emeritus of Anthropology at the University of Iceland, and we're talking about his new book. It's really fascinating. The Last of Its Kind, The Search for the Great Auk and the Discovery of Extinction. Gísli, thanks so much for your time.
Thank you very much. Really pleased to talk to you.
You're listening to WICN 90.5 FM. This is Inquiry. My name's Mark Lynch. Good night.